attachment.
Yeah.
Are Buddhists allowed to send emails? Yes, but only without attachments.
That's good.
Apparently there was somebody on the bicycle pilgrimage when they were on the bus ride back to the parking at the end,
yeah,
who knew about 100 Buddhist jokes and was up in front of the bus telling all the jokes. That's one that was good. I bet you somebody here, if they were in that bus, probably knows a lot more. That's
okay. Hey, how did it go this year? Good? Great. Yeah,
the weather was very nice.
That's perfect weather, yeah.
Yeah, the weather was probably about 80 degrees.
Yeah. Nah, okay. So that's why I wanted to use this today to a few readings. I think we got most everybody. Okay, next. Well, continuing on, I wanted to use the. Some illustrations from the Sutta Nipata, which is it's a collection of teachings from the Kuddhika Nikaya, which is kind of the odds and ends Nikaya, the Sutta Nipata is verses and. It's not very long, but it and some of it is really probably the oldest layers of the Tipitaka, and particularly the it's called the chapter of the eights or the book of the eights, Attikavaga, is there's some internal evidence of its. Within the Tripitaka, references to that. So it's a and much of the particularly the Attikavaga, it's a collection of 16 suttas and verses that and it's yeah much of it much of the Attikavaga is about freeing oneself from attachment in its various forms. Chapter of the Eights, Book of the Eights, is it's mentioned a couple times in other suttas, and there's a good example. There's one sutta in the I think it's the Samyutta Nikaya, I can't remember now. When the Buddha asked the monk Sona to recite all 16 verses or suttas from the Attikavaga for him to see of you. You know, have you learned? Are you learned? Are you up to speed as a monk? Anyway, so that I wanted to use that, and in particular because I just recently read Gil Fronsdale's book, Buddha Before Buddhism. It's a translation and commentary from the Attikavaga, the Book of the Eights. And good language, nice reflections. And I think it's also, in terms of, one, it's pointing of course, it's pointing to these four kinds of clinging quite often. But it's also pointing to the goal in terms of the attainment of peace and realization of true peace. And it's often pointed to in personal terms, but it's also placed in the context of peace from social strife. And that's a, so both the, that's how they say the personal and the social really sort of work together, function together. So the first say clinging to sensuality, clinging to sensual pleasures, kama upadana. There's a and these are a bit terse, but I think that's of course that's what poetry oftentimes is. But I think it's also, you know, it's a the Buddha is quite pointed. So there's a few verses that are sort of clearly pointing to the difficulties of the clinging to sensuality. And these are actually in the very first discourse of the of this Atthagavaka. And this is and kama is sensuality, and so this is the, it's actually called the Kama Sutta. It's not like the tantric Kama Sutra. This is the Buddhist version. When desire for sensual pleasure is fulfilled, one will surely be delighted. The mortals obtained what the mortal wanted. But if this pleasure fades away, the person with this desire, who gives birth to this desire, is pained as if pierced by an arrow. And then the sutta ends with a person ever mindful, therefore turns away from sensual desires. Abandoning them, one will cross the flood like bailing a boat to reach the far shore. That's that image of, because the flood is both a flood of the underlying tendencies, say the asava, the oga, and the... that image of also crossing from danger seeking safety, so bailing one's boat and keeping one afloat. And it there's another. This is from the. Fourteenth discourse, and the discourse on being quick, and the advice is cast in advice to monastics, it's easy to extrapolate. So the advice that the Buddha gives to monastics at that time into sort of something that would be suitable for the modern world, suitable for lay life. Just how do we, because the Buddha gives his advice of dealing with sensuality and the world. One should shut one's ears to village talk, not be covetous with one's eyes, not be greedy for tasty things, or not take anything in the world as mine. touched by sense experience, a monastic shouldn't despair about anything, wish for states of becoming, or tremble at terrors. One shouldn't hoard food, drinks, and clothes received, and shouldn't fret when none of that's obtained. Meditating, not loitering around, restraining restlessness, one shouldn't be negligent. A monastic should live in quiet dwellings. That's a, you know, it's a very simple advice of turning to simplicity, and it's so easy. You know, even in the Buddha's time, to be drawn out into the world of you know, what's the news? What's the, even to like village talk? You know, what, you could hear that around the well in the Buddha's time. Now you just go to your Facebook page, or you know, go to turn on the, go to the news or whatever, and but it's still just village talk. Not really all of it. It's not that different, and that paying attention to this aspect of restraint and simplicity. It's a very restraint simplicity, but then that opens up the opportunity for putting more attention into the practice itself and being mindful. So the next aspects is dit upadana. So upadana again being clinging, grasping, attachment. Ditti is views, opinions, and the Buddha puts a very strong correlation between views and disputes. When we hold a view, we're convinced of a view. When we angle for our view, inevitably we end up in dispute somehow, and that sense of you know, of holding to views, and you know, is one of the indications of, you know, am I holding to a view? Am I attached to views? Is, do I end up in some kind of dispute? Do I end up in some conflict? Do I end up in some misunderstanding in some way? And because that's an inevitable result from the Buddha's perspective. Also, in the sense of paying attention to the benefit of not being drawn into either views or disputes. But also that in the time of the Buddha, there was a very, and I imagine in my years probably is still exists today, just a strong value placed on, like a social value placed on, kind of presenting a view, debating it, arguing it, hammering it out, and winning a debate, and so that's an aspect of course strongly holding to a view in order to distinguish oneself in the world of dispute. And the Buddha is not really praising that. So this is the third sutta, and This is verse 780, and then I'll go to do, there's two more verses a little further on in that sutta. Some dispute with their minds corrupt. Some dispute with truthful minds. Sages do not enter disputes that have arisen, and so do not become despondent anywhere. Those who are cleansed do not form a view about states of becoming or non-becoming anywhere in the world. Having abandoned illusions and conceit, by what means would those who are cleansed go to non-attachment? They are without attachment. One who is attached argues over doctrines. How and with what does one argue with someone unattached? Embracing nothing, rejecting nothing. Right here, a person has shaken off every view. This beautiful, to me, very beautiful aspect of that you know, shaking off of views, because it's the compulsion is very strong, I think especially in it's, you know, probably any culture, but certainly America, if you say that you don't have a particular view on something, you know, who are you? You know, even if you don't even believe in it yourself, you sort of stuff blurts out of your mouth, sort of, because you're afraid that people will look at you as somebody without a view. So that sense of seeing the benefit and the opportunity that arises without having to carrying around one's views. Also, when it says of course, there's all sorts of overlap. You know, when we talk about these four forms of clinging, those who are cleansed do not form a view about states of becoming or non-becoming, because those aspects of states of becoming and non-becoming are also states of being, in the sense of where we create a sense of identity of me and mine. I am a certain state or a certain being of some sort. So that ties into that last form of clinging. But you know, there's overlap in most of them. But this the predominant focus in this is views. And the next one, I'm just going to read a couple from each aspect of clinging. Also, just to encourage people, you know, just letting it sink in or settle. Again, from not so much a philosophical or a doctrinal position, but this the overarching theme today is meditation. And so how can we use this understanding of that impulse for clinging and the relinquishing of clinging to help the mind become more peaceful, more clear, more settled? Just a reminder. This next one is from the eighth sutta, and it's again sort of linking views and disputes, and. You know, it's important to also recognize that one who is say, in from a Buddhist perspective, somebody who is knowledgeable or accomplished or who is a sage is not this sort of vacuous blank slate who can't articulate any kind of idea in their mind whatsoever. That's not the case at all. But as having a perspective that sees clearly and everything is in balance so that one isn't being drawn into one's own compulsion to prop up a view or hold a view or to be pulled in to the views of others. It's helpful. Because sometimes we think, oh, you know, I can't think anything. I can't establish any kind of perspective. I just have non-attachment. Now, that isn't how it works. There's discernment and wisdom functioning. Okay. So these next few verses. Wishing for praise while debating in an assembly, they become anxious. Refuted, they become depressed. Criticized and shaken, they seek their opponent's faults. One whose doctrine is called deficient and by the judges rejected, despairs and grieves. The inferior debater moans, "I have been defeated." Renunciants are elated and deflated by the disputes that arise among them. Seeing this, you should abstain from disputes. They provide no benefit other than being praised. When being praised for proclaiming their creed in an assembly, they laugh and become conceited, having gotten what they wished. While that conceit is a basis for distress, still they speak with arrogance and pride. Seeing this, one shouldn't dispute. Disputes don't lead to purity, say those who are skilled. To the next form of clinging that the Buddha points to is what is called sila bhatta upadana. So again, upadana, clinging. Sila bhatta is, sila is like virtue or precepts. Bhatta is like trainings or practices. Or like this rains retreat, we're studying, as we do every summer, studying the body of monastic discipline. And not the last Vinaya class, but the one before, then we studied the different vattas. Those are called protocols. So certain practices that we take on relationship to how to receive guests, how to look after requisites, how to be a guest going into another monastery, how to look after the teacher, all the different duties or protocols. Those are vata. This next one is from the fourth discourse in this collection, and it's pointing to the problem is the clinging and expectation of purity. Through taking on a certain practice, in terms of I take on these precepts, and I'm going, the clinging is the assumption that somehow, if I do this, then I'm going to get purity out of it. If I do a certain practice, if I meditate enough, I'll get pure. You know? And it's not that you don't meditate or you don't keep precepts. or you don't study the teachings. But it's like you have to realize that in and of themselves, they, again, they're tools that we have to learn how to use skillfully. And we can cling to them with delusion, misunderstanding, complicate them, or we can say disregard them, reject them. But those, that's another form of clinging. So just recognizing that it's so much of the problem is not sort of doing things in a certain way or having certain trainings, but how we relate to it and the clinging and expectation behind it. And that the, in the Buddha, in this discourse and several places throughout this whole Sutta Nipata and this whole section of the Book of the Eights, he comes down on that observances and precepts and because people tend to cling to them and make a problem of them or misunderstand them. But it's not that the Buddha doesn't prescribe proper practices. He does that as well. And that's one of the suttas in this is the whole sutta is basically, it's the last one of the whole collection. And it's the whole sutta. It's a sutta to Sariputta. And it's basically laying out a whole path of practice of how to do things, how to relate to the world around. But anyway, we won't get into that one. But this one is pointing to the clinging and the problem that arises. Okay, so this an excerpt. No true Brahman speaks of purity in terms of something other. In terms of, say, some other being is going to purify me, some if I just believe or rely in some supreme deity, that's something other. So no true Brahman speaks of purity in terms of something other. Or in terms of virtue, religious observances, or what is seen, heard, or thought out. Merit and evil do not adhere to someone who has left behind what's grasped, who doesn't make up anything here. Abandoning one thing, people cling to another. Pursuing craving, they don't transcend their clinging. They let go, they grab. Like a monkey, they release one branch to grasp another. People attach to concepts in undertaking religious observances, experience highs and lows. Great sages, having known by means of knowledge, having understood the Dhamma, don't experience highs and lows. They aren't foes to anything, seen, heard, or thought. How in this world could one have assumptions about those who see in this way, whose conduct is open? They don't categorize, honor, or claim anything to be absolute purity. Having abandoned greed, the knot of attachment, they do not form any wish for anything in the world. True Brahmins who've crossed the boundaries wouldn't grasp anything they can know or see in the world. Neither passionate for passion, nor obsessed by dispassion, there is nothing here to grasp as superior. And this is another good illustration of the, this is chapter 13, a good illustration of the these attachment, the clinging of to precept and practice. Those who say virtue is ultimate dedicate themselves to purity and religious observances, saying, only by training in this will there be purity. Claiming to be skillful, they are faced with further becoming. One who falls away from virtue and observances trembles at having failed at the task and hopes for, longs for, purity, as a poor, far-off traveler hopes for, longs for, home. But whoever has let go of all virtuous conduct and observances, as well as all actions, blamable and blameless, and who has no wishes for purity or impurity, lives without indulging, not even taking up peace. Whoever depends on austerities and on what is seen, heard, and thought, wails for purity, not free from craving for becoming and not becoming. Longing comes from wanting, and with planning there is fear. But with no death and rebirth here, how could one fear? What could one long for? So the next form of clinging that the Buddha points to is in the Pali, which is called attavadupadana. And it's the, Ajahn Dreff translates it as doctrine of self, and assumption of self is maybe a good way to do it, say it as well. Atta, it's really important to sort of realize that what the Buddha what the Buddha is not saying is clinging to self. If clinging to self, it would be atta upadana, and he's, but he's saying atta vadupadana, so that it's, vada is like a doctrine, a teaching, an assumption, a presentation, and that's what happens. Is there, because there, and it's important because what the Buddha is, his teaching depends on anatta, in the sense of not self. So that what we assume to be self is what we cling to, because there isn't an essence of self there that is solid and real and essence. So that you can't cling to something that doesn't exist in the first place. But you can cling to something you assume to be there. And we do that. So that's why this is the Buddha's teaching is really trying to give us the, say, the awareness and discernment to not get caught by the things we assume. And what we assume most often is this sense of I and me and mine. And so attavadupadana. So that the sense of self is the assumption of self is all it's always trying to define and find a place to land or exist or to be or to become or to not become, and you know it's this convolutions of assumption. So the this is in the second discourse of this particular this in this collection. That's I see people thrashing about in the world, thirsting for states of existence, not freed from craving, becoming, and non-becoming. Lowly people weep in the face of death. See them thrashing about in their selfishness, like fish in tiny puddles of a drying stream. Observing this, live unselfishly, not forming attachments to becoming. Subduing desire for both sides, fully understanding sense experience, free of greed, and doing nothing one would reproach oneself for. A sage does not attach to what is seen or heard. Fully understanding concepts and having crossed the flood, sages don't cling to possessions. With arrow removed, living alertly, they do not long for this world or the next. So that, both points to the problem of, say, attachment to assumptions of self, but also gives a nice description of kind of a middle way and the fruits of that. This is from the 14th discourse in this collection. And the Buddha is responding to a question of the question I ask you about seclusion and the state of peace being by seeing what is a monastic freed, not clinging to anything in this world. And the Buddha's response. Let them completely destroy the root of conceptual differentiation. That is, the idea, I am the thinker. Ever mindful, they train to subdue their cravings. They shouldn't get entrenched in any teachings they know, whether their own or that of others. Good people say that being entrenched is not release. They would not, because of this, think themselves better, worse, or equal to others. Experiencing many things, they don't take a stand in thoughts of themselves. Tranquil within, a monastic wouldn't seek peace from others. For one tranquil within, there is nothing embraced. And so how could anything be rejected? Just as when no waves appear in the middle of a still sea, so a monastic, still and unmoving, would not swell with conceit anywhere. Stepping back from those, the compulsion to attach or sustain, it will sustain that sustenance, sense of sustenance, and sustenance in that sense of I, me, and mine, that attawada, that assumption of selfhood. Just to wrap up the. Those are descriptions with a couple illustrations of each of the kinds of clinging. A description of letting go of attachments is just wanted to present a couple. examples of what the Buddha points to in terms of, say, letting go, relinquishing, releasing attachment. And so they... And this is in the fifth discourse. Having views about what is ultimate, a person makes these the best in the world and calls all other views inferior. As such, they have not gone beyond quarreling. Seeing benefit in the self, or in things seen, heard, and thought, or in precepts and religious practices, and then grasping at this, a person then sees all else as inferior. What one relies on in order to see all else as inferior is an entanglement, say those who are skilled. Monastics should therefore not depend on things seen, heard, or thought out, or on virtue and religious observances. Nor should they make up views in the world by means of knowledge, precepts, and religious observances. Nor would they think of themselves inferior or superior to others, and they shouldn't take themselves as equal. Letting go of what is taken up, the person free of grasping doesn't depend on knowledge, or take sides when factions disagree, or fall back on any kind of view. One not inclined to either side, to becoming or non-becoming, to here or the next world, there exists nothing to get entrenched in when considering the doctrines others grasp. Here one does not conceive the slightest concept in regard to what is seen, heard, or thought. How, in this world, could one categorize the Brahman who does not take hold of views? One does not construct, prefer, or take up any doctrine. A true Brahman not led by precepts or religious practices, who has gone beyond, does not fall back on belief, is one who is thus. Thus is tata or tanda, tandi. That's like that's one of the epithets of the Buddha is Tathagata, one gone to thusness. And the last quote that I'll bring up is from the sixth Sutta. It's actually the Jhara Sutra. It's a discourse on old age. This is the very first verse. Short indeed is this life. You will die in less than 100 years. And if living longer, you'll die of old age. And that, anyway, that's, then he ends up with the last three verses of this discourse. Independent everywhere, sages make nothing cherished or not cherished. Despair and selfishness don't stick to them, as water doesn't stick to a leaf. As a drop doesn't stick to a leaf, or water to a lotus petal, so what is seen, heard, or thought doesn't stick to a sage. By being without passion and dispassion, those who are cleansed don't ruminate about what is seen, heard, or thought out, nor do they wish for purity through anything else. So those are things that came to mind when we, because these topics are, we usually sort of pool people over the winter and get various ideas, and this the topic of attachment was suggested, so that so these, and it's a very forms a very central part of the Buddha's teaching and how he presents the, how do you say, the as an origin of suffering, say clinging, attachment, is an aspect of the arising of suffering, and of course the relinquishing of clinging is a way of accessing that cessation of suffering, experiencing that the freedom from agitation in the mind. This is a well. Are there any questions before we go on? Yeah.
I'm wondering, where would physical pain, would that fit under sensuality? It's sort of like the opposite of pushing away, or is that not really fitting
under? Well, no. I mean, you can fit it in. You can fit it in anywhere, really. I mean, in the sense of sensuality, in the sense that one is in discomfort because of pain, and is seeking relief from that pain through something pleasurable, or one is through that desire to be comfortable, is then thrust into aversion or fear toward pain. So that you start seeing how these you start teasing it out and seeing a causal process. So it isn't as if all sense, say, create attachment to sensuality or attachment to sensual pleasure is just getting pleasurable sensation, but it's also the whole constellation of reactions, like the whole sense of fear that comes up around, say, not being able to get what one wants, is an aspect of that clinging, and or that desire for security and stability, so that it's stable and isn't going to change. So those are all the permutations, and it's important to not get too locked into, it's got to fit this narrow. So you start seeing, you start teasing it out and seeing how that that affects it, or in their the view that the human body shouldn't experience pain. That's what's been a huge, especially in America, prescribing of just gobs and gobs of painkillers. Because the view that one, really the duty of the medical profession is to make sure we as human beings don't experience any pain, so there's the view is there, and relationship to pain. So you can start teasing it out and reflecting it on it in many different ways.
Yeah. The last quote that you read said something about not clinging to, or passion and dispassion.
Right.
I don't recall hearing that. Usually I recall hearing say that cultivating dispassion is actually a good thing.
Yes, and that's exactly the what many of the in this Sutta Nipata, and particularly in the Atthakavagga, is saying that even the things that we think are good, if we form an attachment to it, it'll come back and bite us, and it'll limit us. So that even, you know, when the Buddha praises dispassion, or he praises keeping precepts, once you start clinging to it, it's going to limit you and it's going to create suffering. It'll be an attachment. So we'll reap the fruits of it. So that it's making sure that things are, say, understood and in balance, so that one's not being entangled in that clinging process.
I'm thinking this is regarding meditation specifically.
Yeah.
So are you saying that these things would come up in our meditation and then we would cling to them? So if there was, I could see where like pain would come up, and then there'd be an aversion to it. So you're clinging to not wanting it. But I don't know, I don't get into too many quarrels when I'm meditating with myself, but I'm trying to. I don't. I'm trying to think about how I might run into those things. And I know attachment's easy. Okay.
Yeah. We tend to certain tracks that we're more like by temperament we're more familiar with, so that's just understanding that more clearly, but even when we it's like disputes, we end up kind of in dispute with ourselves sometimes, holding to some particular perspective or something being contrary about. There's many permutations to that. But certainly that we don't have to experience all of them. One's enough to make you suffer.
It was very clear. Basically, quarreling is just no good.
Absolutely.
Very clearly.
Yeah.
I heard that over and over and over.
Yeah.
And I know that that's difficult because you want things to be a certain way. Wouldn't you want the world to be at peace and people not killing each other and blah, 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 right?
Yeah.
All those things. Not wanting these things. And then how do we go about that? So it's a little... I don't know, it's like you don't have anything you can do but try to espouse a certain view.
Well, it's also, again, it's not so much espousing a view, but presenting a way forward. It was like what we were talking with, like when what Laura brought up was a good example. And how do we support each other as human beings, as opposed to divide ourselves into camps of who's right, who's wrong, who holds this view, who holds that view, who takes this stand, who takes that stand. And it's more like, how do we relate to each other as human beings who are suffering, but who are also capable of freedom from suffering.
Can you distinguish between clinging and craving? In that clinging is the precondition of becoming. Why can't we just drop clinging and go to craving? What is it about that?
Well, in the dependent origination teachings, craving, I mean, feeling, we experience, and then craving arises. And of course it's fed by ignorance, delusion, not understanding the true nature of things. So craving is the next sort of movement of the mind. So it's that craving, that impulse to be, become, to get rid of, to acquire, to experience. So there's that craving. And then we tend to, and it's still a little bit unformed, but then it's that clinging that creates a little better focus for it. Okay, where our craving settles on sensual desire, or sensual pleasure, or a particular view.
A content.
It's like giving a content to that craving. And then that's where that word sustenance is actually really helpful or good. It's being sustained, and we're seeking sustenance through it in a certain way. Go ahead.
So to break the chain of dependent origination, or to kind of experience whatever that is, and to get, is it possible to, the whole experience of attachment in that, to make a break?
That's where suffering is so important. It's like Ajahn Chah's classic kind of description of dependent origination, or illustration of dependent origination, because because you've got these 12 links of the dependent origination chain. It's all very logical and sequential, and looks really clear. And he said, it's not how it works. in experience, he said it's like you're up in a tree and you fall down from a tree. As you're falling down, you're not counting the branches as you go down. But all you know is that you hit the bottom, it's going to hurt. So similarly with that dependent origination, it's helpful to have those as a kind of framework for reflection. But when it comes to experience, it's that experience of dukkha, of suffering, because where did I bite into this? Where did I really get tripped up? What really hooked me? And that's so that we can use those different links to reflect on.
So in the readings you did, the Buddha referred to what is seen, heard, and thought.
Yes.
Could you comment on that a little bit? Because I guess in the context of meditation, it would be like just developing an awareness of what you're thinking, hearing, and seeing, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it as kind of simple as that, or what do you think? There's more to that?
No, I mean that's enough. That'll keep.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's enough to keep you going. But it is an idiom, because sometimes. The Buddha will point to the whole six sense base, seen, heard, smell, taste, touch, thought. But then this happened a couple places here, and it comes up in many other places through the suttas where the Buddha uses seen, heard, conceived or thought, and so it's that's where the other senses are subsumed into that experience, because whatever the case, we still have to think about or remember or experience through the mind the other sense doors that contribute to the our experience of the moment. Yeah. Let's take an opportunity to, again, this is the overarching theme is meditation, so that so to sit quietly for a few minutes anyway, just to let these teachings resonate, and say the topic was sort of, can we function without attachment? You know, what would it be like? Breathing in and breathing out without attachment. Or what does attachment actually feel like? When the mind moves, what does attachment feel like? Because it's important, in order to relinquish anything, we have to feel it, experience it. Also, what attachments we've gone over quite a lot of detail of attachment, and you know, what kinds of attachments tend to come up? How do they manifest? And what's the habit of the mind? Now, what's the familiar track that the mind goes down? Can we choose a place of, you know, just that sense of non-attachment? That's where, say, like contemplation of space is really helpful. So often attachment is looking for an object. So then to just contemplating space, allowing space to be an object of contemplation. And what do we take as an abiding place for the mind, for attention? Those were that we abide in or are sustained. Seek sustenance in certain objects. That both recognizing those patterns of clinging, but then and taking an object of non-clinging, space. There, just paying attention to those interesting shifts of attention. And what do they feel like? Again, it's so important that our meditation, our practice, comes back to the Four Noble Truths. Just as Sariputta described, the Four Noble Truths as being like the elephant's footprint. It's all animals in the world fit in, and their footprint can fit in the elephant's footprint. All teachings of the Buddha, all teachings that were given fit into this elephant's footprint of the Four Noble Truths. bringing it back. Just investigating and experimenting. Okay, so we could have a break and maybe 15 minutes, come back. So it's 3:05 right now, 3:20, come back.